Swipe Special Edition number 6. We are going to be talking today about Daredevil Season 2. So if this is automatically downloaded into your iTunes feed and you haven't finished, this might be about the right time to stop and come back when you finish Daredevil Season 2. As always, if you want to get in touch with us or you want to talk to us about Daredevil, anything else on TV, you can do so by getting hold of us on Twitter, which is at Hero Hype Podcast. You can leave us a comment on this post when it goes up on Hypeable.com, or you can send us an email, which is HeroHypePodcast@gmail.com. As always, I'm Danya, and I'm joined by my regular Hero Hype co-host, Caitlin.
Hello.
We have returning guest host, Kristen.
Hi.
And brand new guest host for this episode, Gamble.
Hello.
Yeah. So, like I said, we're going to be talking all about Daredevil Season 2, but before we start getting into a sort of deep dive, what was your kind of initial reaction to Daredevil Season 2 as a whole? Like, did you enjoy it compared to Season 1? Did it hold up now that we've had another show in this universe with Jessica Jones? Like, has your opinions changed now that we've got a second season and we've seen this little bit of the universe expand a bit? Caitlin, how about you?
I quite enjoyed Season 2. I wouldn't have finished it in 2 days if I hadn't. I was enjoying every little nod to Jessica Jones that we got, which was fun. I have some thoughts that we'll talk about, but it was fun to come back into this little section of New York with this little group of characters that I really fell in love with in the first season, so I quite enjoyed it.
Gamble, how about you?
I think I had considerably more mixed feelings, but I did like returning to Hell's Kitchen and the group of characters that I really loved last season. I think tonally it shifted and that changed for me, but I think that's probably something to go into later.
And Kristen, how about you?
I really liked Season 2. I liked Season 1, but it wasn't a show that I felt the need to go back and rewatch. When Karen and I started our Season 1 rewatch right before Season 2, I was kind of like meh about it. Like, I watched it, but I did other things while we were doing it. But as soon as Season 2 started, like, it just drew me in, and I really liked some of the plot lines and things that they chose for Season 2. So I think I'm definitely a little more I'm a bigger fan of Season 2 than Season 1.
I enjoyed Season 2. There are a couple of things that bothered me a little bit this season that were holdovers from Season 1 that I kind of thought that potentially when they readdressed it in Season 2 we might see a bit of a shift, a bit of a change, because from some of the trailers I knew that they'd be picking up that as part of the storyline, and I thought maybe we'd get a little bit of variation on the theme, but it didn't work out exactly the way I'd been hoping it would. But on the whole, I think I enjoyed it quite a lot. I've gone back and rewatched quite a few episodes, so it's definitely got rewatch value for me because I had to go back and look at things that I thought I might have missed the first time round. But I have my issues with it, but I do think I enjoyed it on the whole. But I guess we'll get right into our spoilery talk. So if for some reason you've stuck around just to hear our initial reactions and you still haven't finished Daredevil Season 2, stop, turn back. This is the point of no return because it's no holds barred from this point. So I think let's get started with the titular character. Let's talk about Matt Murdock in this season. And I think the one incredibly positive thing that I can give him credit for this season is he didn't lose a single cane. That's an accomplishment. Yeah, I think that's about as far as I'm probably going to go. But with Matt this season, how did you guys feel about him as a character? Because obviously through Season 1, his motivations and his setup as a character was quite straightforward. You know, he was set up as a kind of conflicted hero who didn't want to resort to massive amounts of violence or killing in order to keep his city, I say his city, it's a couple of blocks within a city, safe. But with season two and how that played out from start to finish, do you think we were meant to actually like him by the end of the season? In fact, did you like him by the end of the season? Kristen?
I mean, there's a part of me, as you're supposed to, you do like Matt Murdock. You cheer him on, you hope for him, because he is Daredevil, and ultimately you know he's doing what he thinks is right. He's trying to do good. By the end of the season, I was pissed at him. He made some really bonehead choices and did some really ridiculous things that I still can't believe he did. And it just, you know, like, it just, him not being honest with people about things he definitely could have been honest about, and him putting Foggy and Karen kind of on the back burner while he deals with Elektra and all of her business, like, it just, it didn't sit right. Like, you know, as a fan of the trio and seeing them be on the same side, kind of seeing Matt drift to the other side, almost like him versus Foggy and Karen, just felt so wrong. And yeah, so that would be my biggest problem with Matt, is like, something is not quite right with him at the moment, and it hurts.
Yeah. Caitlin, how about you?
So Danya got my stream of comments while I was watching, and one of them was that Matt was doing his best Oliver Queen impersonation this season, trying getting like self-righteous and self-loathing and everything I don't like about Oliver Queen he was doing. So I hope we weren't supposed to be positive towards him by the end of the season, because I felt like the first couple of episodes he was fine, but when we start bringing in Elektra, she really brings out the worst in him. I think he's good for her, but she is terrible for him. And the more he gravitated towards her and everything going on with Stick, and put Foggy and Karen on the back burner with Frank's trial, which Matt had been insistent on dealing with in the first place, he lost everything that he was really trying to protect in season one, and he does it to himself. And that's very frustrating. It's human and it makes sense in a way, but it's frustrating to watch him repeatedly have chances to make a better choice, because Karen and Foggy give him numerous chances to pull himself together, and he is just not able to do it. And that gets so frustrating by the end of the season. So I was very annoyed with him by the end.
Yeah, I think your comparison to him being like Oliver Queen is pretty accurate, because this was definitely, at least like season one, season two, Oliver Queen kind of levels of going off and doing incredibly stupid things and being incredibly self-righteous. And I didn't necessarily see him as the hero this season, like, at all. I think he really self-destructed both his personal life, his professional life, and his superhero vigilanteism life. But yeah, I don't know. I think the point where I was like, Matt has completely gone off the rails and he has no idea what he's doing anymore and he's like completely lost the plot, was when he essentially started giving a closing statement in the middle of questioning a witness on trial. And I was like, they're going, pretty sure you've forgotten how to lawyer at this point as well.
Yes, I had the same thought.
Yeah, I don't know. Gamble, how about you? How did you feel about Matt this season?
I think he hasn't really gotten much. Well, he has gotten considerably more self-righteous since last season. I understand it in the character trajectory of him finding some sort of stability and finding some sort of, I suppose, role to play. Which is also funny when Frank is like, you know, they do call you the devil, and Matt's like, I don't know why they do that. Well, wearing a red suit and, you know, plastic horns and just sort of settling into that niche. But I really did find him quite unbearable by the end of the season, which is saying something, because weirdly enough, that was what drew me to the first season, so.
Yeah, same. I really loved Matt's journey through season one. I thought they balanced it particularly well, but I will say one thing for Matt's almost self-destructive tendencies throughout his entire life this season. It wasn't miraculously solved by the end. He didn't get everything that he wanted by the end of the season. So, you know, things didn't work out. You know, he's lost his practice. Foggy has moved on. Karen has moved on. He's lost Electra. Stick has peaced out to go and fight this war, this nondescript war that we're still not entirely sure what's going on with there, off somewhere. You know, he's kind of legitimately all on his own this time, and that's kind of something that he did to himself. So I kind of like that even though he did all of this stuff, they didn't reward him for it by the end of the season, which sometimes shows can do. Like, things can just miraculously work out by the end of the season. And the Matt that we've got by the end is someone who isn't necessarily a hero and has done some stupid things and hasn't been rewarded for it. So, I mean, I don't know. He was very, I don't know how to explain it. I wanted to strangle him through most of this season, basically. I don't know.
Well, to his credit, in that, like, one of the last scenes when he meets Karen to tell her he's Daredevil, like, at least he does seem to be, in the end, trying to make amends in some way. Like, he's reaching out to someone that's important to him. So that's hopefully a shift in the right direction for him.
I mean, we can hope. I don't know what Karen will do with that information now that she has it. I mean, I guess at this point, it's better than her thinking that he's an alcoholic. I mean,
he's an addict, but not necessarily to alcohol.
Yeah. But obviously we see the introduction of Frank Castle right at the start of this season, and it sets up a really good parallel between the two of them. Obviously we are introduced a lot through season one of Daredevil to Matt's kind of moral code, and we see him trying to uphold it quite a lot through this season as well, despite, you know, slips and kind of him self-destructing in other ways. But how do you feel that they handled Frank Castle as a character? Because he's a very, very difficult character, I think, to bring to the screen, because I don't know if any of you are familiar with the comics, but he's not necessarily a good character. He's not necessarily a full-on villain either. He kind of falls into this kind of middle area, gray area that kind of fluctuates between the two. And you feel very, very conflicted about whether or not you like him. Do you think the show did a good job with kind of bringing him to the screen? Kristen?
Okay, when you first meet Castle and, you know, you see just how violent and intense this character is, like, you're scared of him. You think of him as the bad guy. And then as the season wears on and you see him through Karen's eyes and you see him through Matt's eyes and, you know, you see him through the eyes of people who actually do believe in his cause, people who are, you know, have been afraid to step out onto the sidewalk at night and now the criminals are, like, you see that not, while his way of doing things is not great, he is killing people, it's also not completely awful. You start to see that Frank Castle is so much more than just a murderer, so much more than just a killer. And watching him and Karen throughout this season just, like, understand each other and get closer and closer was my favorite thing that this show has ever done. So I really, really liked Frank Castle. It took a little while to kind of understand what was going on for me, but as soon as I got into what makes him tick, I was sold.
Gamble, how about you? How did you feel about what they did with Frank this season?
Well, I don't know anything about the comics version of Frank, but I found his character compelling from the start, because from his physicality to the things that he does and the reasons that he gives, and the entire performance is very consistent for me with what his motivations are meant to be, and he has a relatively clear trajectory, which I had a harder time picking up in the other characters this season. But just in terms of him not being good, but being essentially the one bad day version of Matt, which I know is such a comics cliche, but it's a very interesting look at that same sort of weariness that in season one leads Matt to go, I can't do this alone, and eventually, I suppose, leads Frank to decide that he's, you know, no longer going to be a person with a history, but take on that equally sort of mythic role.
Yeah. Caitlin, how about you?
I was really impressed with how his relationship with Karen was used to humanize him. Like, when we start seeing him, he seems like he's just going to be a villain, but it's through his interactions with Karen above everybody that we see his humanity. And Karen is the one who is really willing to stand up for his humanity and acknowledge it. Like, she breaks into his house and sees all these signs of everything that he's lost. And so the fact that not only does he protect her on multiple occasions and goes out of his way to make sure she's okay, and he like really needs her to know after he escapes prison, like, that he's not the one killing people. Like, it's important to him that she know that, which is kind of amazing, but that she is looking at his humanity and standing up for it. And that's really what, for me, keeps him down to earth, that he has this one relationship with Karen, who is such a human character in her own right, that it really just grounds him for me in a way, because he could very easily be cartoonish or he could just go off the rails, but she kind of sticks up for him and she said, you know, he is a murderer, like, he is killing people, so I'm not contesting that he needs to be in prison, but he does have a code, and, like, he makes the point of saying, you know, you were never in danger when I was going after the guy in the hospital. Like, I was never going to hurt you, and my aim is good. So, like, he, for all of his darkness, like, he's not aiming to hurt innocence, which, I mean, they say, you know, motives are important, and so his motives aren't to hurt innocence. So I think there's a lot of gray area with him, but what they did with Karen just worked so well to round him out as a character for me.
Yeah, I kind of really loved both his, like Gamble said, that like setting him up as being a character who was essentially one bad day, the Daredevil version. So having one bad day and kind of literally just being like, yeah, okay, that's it. When we knock them down, we keep them down, kind of thing. But I loved the parallels that they drew between him and Matt through the entire season and what he was willing to do to keep people safe. But not only that, how they kind of framed that all through Karen as well. Like, they teased out his entire backstory through her. And I found myself really oddly compelled by that relationship more than most of the relationships in this season. Like, by the time they were going down the route with Matt and Karen and trying to like set up the romance angle there, I was already like completely uninterested in that and overly invested in everything going on with Frank and Karen. So I really loved how they used her as the basis to kind of frame his humanity and frame him as a character who was not only a vigilante with a more lethal angle, but also someone who was, for all intents and purposes, a hero. He was also a father and a husband. But how about you, Gamble? How did you find his relationship with Karen through this season? Were you interested in seeing how that played out?
I was actually really intrigued by the sort of it's almost like the resonance that they have with each other, for whatever reason, her making decisions which are incredibly questionable given the vigilante manhunt situation, like breaking into people's houses and threatening the DA's assistant, and him basically doing every single thing that he does. But that sort of weird resonance of still having that strong moral compass, that sort of internal sense of why they're doing what they're doing, I thought that was interesting to look at. So I was also hoping that Karen would get a slightly more complexity in terms of the universe maybe not approving of her every decision, which I think she's a very interesting character, and I love how she's, through both seasons, been willing to do things that are not admissible in court, for example, like breaking into houses, like going through files that she isn't meant to have access to. But just in terms of bringing in something from season one, for example, the Wesley thing, or having her make a decision that isn't immediately sanctioned by the universe at large, which was, it seemed to be not the case to me. I don't know if that's the sense that everybody got. I'm not sure if I've done a good job of articulating it either, but
no, I get what you mean, like the yeah, I do. I understand that. I kind of was expecting them actually to play on the Wesley thing a hell of a lot more with her for a driving force through this season, which I was actually quite surprised that they didn't focus on that, and instead it was more nods back to her past prior to New York. But I don't know, I kind of thought it was also a little bit interesting that the actual situation of what happened with Wesley wasn't something that came out to Frank, because she kept saying you don't know, or maybe I do deserve such and such at certain points through the season. But I was quite surprised that that didn't come out in the open, either to Matt or to Frank or anyone. I was quite surprised that actually stayed under wraps. But if Frank had learnt that she had killed someone, how do you think he would have reacted to knowing that?
Well, if you do it after he's met Fisk, I think it definitely is something he could embrace. Once he knows that this guy that she killed was Fisk's right-hand man and was doing everything in his power to keep his boss in business, like, I can see him understanding what was going through Karen's head, and especially if she at all describes the situation she was in, like, he's going to get it. If maybe he didn't know Fisk and didn't know the situation, he might question it at first, you know, like Wesley wasn't necessarily a violent offender or anything, like he wasn't all, you know, the guy swinging the hammer all the time, so I could see him kind of just being questioning of it. But as soon as he knew what Wesley's role was in Fisk's organization, I can see him like co-signing what she did and taking her under his wing, like, you know, like, I understand why you did it, and comforting her through what she's going through.
I think it would depend on what point it from, I think, episode 6 onwards, at what point that conversation took place, because Frank seems to be a very live by the sword sort of character, and given the almost trust he establishes with Karen through the second half of the season, I'm not even sure that he would question the situation that led to that or a context. I think definitely by their last conversation, he would just say, you know, I'm sure you had your reasons, or something similar, something considerably more frank toned than that. But just in terms of, for example, he's surprised that she didn't shoot him. So I'm not sure if he would even question it. But I think I might be taking a slightly more pragmatic view of his character. I'm not sure.
I think I'd agree with that. I think definitely by the end of the season, by the time he knows Karen more, and by the time he becomes aware of Fisk and Fisk's organization and people who operate with Fisk and what he's capable of, like, I think that he would probably view it in the frame of the same thing that he's doing, is stopping someone who is, by all intents and purposes, not a good guy at all. Because as little violence as Wesley was responsible for at his own hands, he was very responsible for orchestrating a lot of it. So, you know, I think if the truth of the situation came out, he would definitely, by the end of the season, not question it. Or he definitely wouldn't put her in the same category as some of the people that he was taking out, which I think, yeah, I really, really just loved his moral code through this whole thing. And it just, it's so interesting to see him in the same universe where we've got characters. Obviously, I don't know, Gamble, if you're watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. as well, but where we've got characters like Ward and like Coulson, who we also have not exactly the same sort of questioning morals as we do with Frank, especially not with Ward, but in their eyes, in Ward's and Coulson's eyes, the things that they're doing are probably along the same moral code in their eyes. And I think it's just really interesting to look at it across all of the Marvel properties. But yeah, it's definitely being confronted with Frank in this season has made me look a little bit differently at Coulson in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I don't know if I'll ask Caitlin, because I know that we've had this conversation before. Has it made you look at other characters that we've had in the Marvel Universe differently?
No. I mean, the situations are so different. Frank is working as a solo operator, essentially, whereas Coulson is the leader of a well-organized spy organization. Like, he has a lot of other people that he's responsible, whereas Frank is just, he's responsible for Frank, he's responsible to Frank, and the only thing he needs to be able to do is do what helps him sleep at night, and that's not true of Coulson. So it doesn't, the parallels don't really match up for me.
I was kind of looking at it where, at the point where we got the end of, the mid-season finale, is where he's removed himself from that position of power, is what I was re-looking at it as, and kind of thinking, does this change things for me? And I don't think I've definitively come to a decision about that yet. I think I'll need to rewatch part of this season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. again, because I don't know. I think it might vaguely change a little bit of how I view things. But
I mean, I don't feel like Frank's story is one that we've never seen in any media before. So it's not unfamiliar territory to have someone who is victimized and loses things and goes out and starts killing bad people. Like, that's not brand new territory. So I don't feel like this informs anything new for me, because it's not a new story. It's always something I've been familiar with when I'm looking at someone like Coulson and his actions.
Gamble or Kristen, do you watch S.H.I.E.L.D., or has it changed how you look at S.H.I.E.L.D. if you've been watching it?
I don't actually watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., or haven't since, I think, about two episodes into the second season. It actually took me a moment to remember they're in the same universe, so I will bow out of this one.
No, that's okay.
I watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I don't know if I, again, it's hard for me, I watch all of these, and it's hard for me to remember they all exist in the same universe, because it does feel different. Like, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. feels so much different from the Daredevil universe. I don't think it's affected the way I look at Coulson. It's, again, as Caitlin said, like, it's not a story I'm unfamiliar with. This has been, you know, it's a anti-hero motivation that is classic. Like, I've read it before, I've seen it before. So I don't think it has. Will it? Maybe. I mean, down the road here, possibly, but I don't think it has so far.
So obviously we find out about Frank as we go through the season, and as we get his whole story teased out, that his family dying was a sting operation gone wrong, and the person at the center of all of this was his CO from his days in the Marines and in the military. While this was playing out, did you see that coming? I know Caitlin has a very specific reaction to this, actually.
I just, one of the things that I sent Danya was like, well, of course the Clancy Brown character was sketchy. He's freaking Lex Luthor. So I didn't know that necessarily he was the blacksmith, but when he first showed up, I'm like, okay, there's going to be something sketchy about this guy at some point, because you don't cast Clancy Brown unless you want, like, somebody kind of evil under the surface.
Yeah, I did. See, this is the thing, is that I was kind of like, yeah, I know exactly who this person is in respect to the other roles that he's played outside of this show. I did not automatically assume that he was a bad guy, and that's probably more fool me, actually, because I think I said as much to Caitlin when we were messaging back and forth while we were watching was, yeah, that was probably dumb of me. How about you, Gamble? Did you see this kind of twist coming, that it was going to be Frank Seo kind of behind everything?
Absolutely not. But also, that was deep into, like, day two, and I'd lost track of all the proper nouns at that point that were being flung around. So that's probably on me as well.
Yeah, I think this is... I think I was speaking to someone else. I think it was Karen from Hyperbole, who... We were working on an Easter eggs article together, like, going through things and figuring out where it all connected to the wider universe and back to the comics. And I was starting to think of things, and I was like, I can't remember what episode this actually happened in as I was going through, because they all just blurred into one really long episode. But how about you, Kristen? Did you see this coming?
No, and again, I should have. I know this actor, too. I've seen him in a million things, and I should have known. Like, I remember when he first kind of stepped on screen, and I recognized, like, his face. I was like, interesting choice. I know why, you know, like, I could tell why they chose him, but okay, cool. And then as things went on, and, like, you know, that final confrontation between him and Karen, like, when she steps into his place at night to talk to him, I'm like, oh, this is gonna end badly. And, like, midway through that scene, like, I put it all together and I looked at Karen, roommate Karen, and was like, yeah. And she goes, don't say it, I know. And, like, we all kind of put it together at the same moment. So, yeah, didn't see it coming, but I probably should have.
Yeah, I didn't either. I felt really dumb after the fact, especially when Caitlin was messaging me being like, of course he's a bad guy. Oh, dear.
And he's a villain on The Flash, too.
He is. Mm-hmm. He is. Should have seen him. Should have seen it coming. Should have. Didn't, but should have. Right, so before we move on to our other brand new character, I wanted to touch on that big fight that we get between Daredevil, well, not necessarily between Daredevil and Frank, but it comes in the aftermath of episode 3, when we have that really amazing rooftop scene where they kind of put their moral codes up against each other, and we have pretty much the successor of the hallway fight from the first season. Now, I'm still not entirely sold on this scene in total, because I think in terms of choreography, it was beautiful. Like, it was very, very well done and well executed. But for me, it was a lot of style over substance, that, at least in season one, that fight in the hallway pushed the story forward, because you had a very clear goal at the end of it, which was to save the kid who was in a very high amount of peril, because you knew that the motivations of the people that Matt was fighting against were not particularly great, and they would essentially kill them. But also, at that point, we don't know whether Matt is skilled enough to beat all of them. So there was a lot of tension as well. So in terms of servicing the story, I think it was a very good scene. I think for me, this felt more like, and especially because of how long it was, it's almost like 4 minutes long. I thought it went on a little bit too long for me personally, but also that it wasn't entirely necessary. For me, the scene that I felt was the almost spiritual successor in more ways to that season one scene was when we get Frank in the prison against everyone in the hallway after he's killed Dutton. It's Dutton's the name of the guy, wasn't it?
Yes.
I think, yeah. So after, for me, that felt like a more worthy successor to that first hallway scene, whereas this one just felt, for me, like they were just trying to outdo themselves. I don't know how you guys felt about it.
Yeah, the staircase. Yeah, like the staircase fight, while incredibly choreographed, as you said, like it was really well done. It, for me, it read a little long. I think the first two landings of the staircase fight, like I mentally connected the two and said, oh, clearly they're trying to step up the hallway scene from last year. Like when you can take yourself out of the action and like make the connection during the scene, it takes something away from it. Like it wasn't as naturally impressive as the hallway scene was. For me, especially, like, I think there was something about watching that scene in the first season and seeing Matt, like, he's out of breath. He almost can't go on, but he does because he knows he has to. Here, it felt more aggressive. Like, it felt like there was more to it than just him trying to save someone or him trying to, you know, get out of there. So it didn't measure up for me either. I think it was a little bit of style over substance. And I do agree with the Frank scene. That fight on the landing in the prison is fantastic and had that same like high stakes level of intensity that the hallway scene did the season before. So I also agree that Frank's fight scene is definitely the more equal successor for me.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that, because in that original hallway sequence, besides the cinematography and just the panning back and forth, which I really loved in that, there was that very sort of clear emotional, the way that it furthered the emotional story and the character, just in terms of how exhausted Matt clearly is, but he also takes off his mask before he goes into the room and picks up the kid, which is just a very good beat in terms of he has literally beaten down everyone else in the hallway, but he still knows why he's there. Whereas the staircase sequence was A, harder to see, and I watched most of this show with my brightness cranked up an inch away from my laptop anyway, but it was also an impressive choreography set piece without, as far as I can tell, anything near that emotional impact, unlike, as I think everyone has said so far, the sequence in the prison where it demonstrates, it's an exhibition of Frank's character as well. It's that very sort of dogged perseverance against the odds.
I think that's a good point, because Matt's season one hallway fight was his kind of like showing his character as we were getting to know him and how hard he works and fights to protect an innocent, and that he's going to go to these extremes to do what he needs to do. Whereas in the second season with the staircase fight, we already know these things about Matt. So he's not proving anything in that. It's just there to be like, hey, look what we did. So technically it's very cool, but it doesn't tell us anything we didn't already know about his abilities or his character. Whereas for Frank, it does tell us something. And one of the shots of the whole season that sticks out to me in my mind is just that shot after Frank has killed everybody and is lying on the floor in that white jumpsuit. He's got like blood on him and there's all the yellow orange suited bodies around him. Like that shot, just like I can still see it perfectly in my head because it was just such a powerful shot. So that scene was definitely the spiritual successor to season one scene for me too.
Did you catch the really, I say really cool, but it's a really neat little nod to his Punisher symbol in that scene when he's lying back and he's got the blood on the front of that white suit. When it gets darker in the middle, if you look really closely, it actually makes the outline of the Punisher symbol there as well, the skull symbol. You have to look really, really closely. But it was that was something that we picked up when we were digging in for, like, Easter eggs and stuff. We were like, is that the Punisher symbol? It is the Punisher symbol in blood. Okay.
That's pretty perfect, because he's the Punisher is literally created in blood as a character.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't catch it in that sequence. I did catch the subtle look of it in the, like, flak jacket thing that he steals from the blacksmith, like, when they're in the cabin and he's already killed him. Like, I caught it, the look of it in that. I didn't catch it there until Karen showed me when you guys were doing the Easter eggs article. And I was like, oh my god, that's so cool. So, yeah, definitely missed it in the moment, but it's fun to look back and see how many times they snuck the logo in there without us knowing.
And it's a lot. But let's move on to the other big character that we were introduced to this season. So pretty much the first part of this season was introducing and kind of following through the Frank Castle storyline. But around the midway point, we start seeing Elektra and Elektra's storyline introduced. So we find out that there's a little bit more to Matt's ex-girlfriend than we may have been led to believe in season one. So we find out that the whole relationship that Matt and Elektra had was pretty much orchestrated by Stick, who had, for a portion of Elektra's life, raised her, trained her, and had worked with her. So had sent her out to kind of drag Matt back into that life and kind of stop him from wanting to seek justice as a lawyer and pretty much have a slightly more normal life. But how did you feel they dealt with Elektra's character throughout this season? Gamble, how about you?
I don't have that much comics background on Elektra. Again, I think I read the Del Mundo ongoing while that was the thing, but I was generally confused by her motivations, and I think I expected her to be acting a little more on her own steam as a character, which threw me off for most of the season, and I was left really confused as to whether she did want to get out, whether she did want to be with Matt in the end, because that seemed to be the end game in that last conversation that they have. But before that, she just seems to want to, I suppose, paint the town, essentially, and then get out again. And then Stick comes back again. They were two confusing days of my life, but I was left incredibly at sea.
Yeah, I think just in general, this is the storyline for me. Elektra's and the Hand and the Chaste were the storyline for me that got muddled up a lot and wasn't clear enough and wasn't a clear enough resolution for me. They dropped a lot of stuff and they didn't, it wasn't set out as clearly and as concisely as Frank's storyline for me as we saw it play out. So I kind of kept getting whiplash. I think without my comic book knowledge and knowing Elektra's origins and a lot more about the Hand and the Chaste from the comics, I think I would have been a hell of a lot more confused in this half of the season. But I don't know. Caitlin, how did you feel about Elektra as a character?
I found her exceptionally unlikable. So I hope we weren't supposed to like her. And I could not get invested in anything between her and Matt because I found she was really the biggest enabler of his self-destructionist tendencies that were pissing me off all season. So while it seemed like he was maybe good for her and that he was like trying to make her feel like she could be more than she was, she brought out every terrible trait Matt Murdock has. So I just found her so unlikable and I could not get behind their relationship. So I had a really hard time with it.
Yeah, when she first showed up, I thought she was an interesting sort of counter to to, like, we have this whole thing going on with Frank and Matt, and then she shows up and kind of throws Matt's head into a tizzy, and I thought she was really interesting at first, and then as it went on, she was just kept pulling him further and further away from the Matt Murdock that we know and love. Like, she's yanking him away from everything that is important to him and everything that he's built in Hell's Kitchen, and that alone is what made me, like, just basically count down the minutes to her being off screen. Like, every time Elektra showed up, I was like, great. You know, like, I know exactly what's coming. I know exactly how this is going to happen because I didn't expect anything better from her. So, yeah, definitely not my favorite character. I liked what she brought in the beginning, but as Matt just sort of fell further and further away from what we like from him, it got really, really hard to find redeeming qualities in her.
I think this is the part where I sort of wish the show had committed a little more, at least to making Matt more solidly unlikable, if that was the direction. But just in terms of, I would have had less difficulty understanding her character and her motivations and what she was trying to get Matt to do if perhaps she hadn't constantly gone back and said, you know, I'm so glad that you still have that light inside you while still bringing out those worst traits in him. I think I would have been all right with her being essentially that one bad day if she'd been more consistent or if her character had been written more consistently in that regard.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you think that Elektra's trait of being able to bring out the worst in Matt is, and her, almost her conflicting, the way she kind of flip-flops back and forth between not knowing what she really wants, do you think that's something that's down to how Stick raised her and how she kind of connected back with Stick and has been using her again to kind of get to Matt when she was older? So do you think that that's down to the chaste and how she was brought up through them before being left with another family, and I guess basically how they used her and trained her? Do you think that's where the conflict in her has come from, and her not really, I guess, whether or not she has her own agency, or whether it's all completely kind of guided by what Matt is trying to make her see versus what Stick is?
I could see that. Every time we flashed back to Stick with her, I was just cringing at what a terrible job he was doing, like, quote-unquote, raising a child. Like, he was basically laying the groundwork for decades of therapy every time he opened his mouth. So I guess it shouldn't be surprising that she grew up the way she did and had so much internal conflict over these, like, whatever these urges she has or bloodlust she has, because she was pretty much raised by someone who had no idea what they were doing.
But you also kind of see that with how Stick also treated Matt as well. It's kind of the way I viewed what the chase did to pretty much Matt and to Elektra is that it's essentially a cult. The way that they've been brought up and manipulated and kind of cut off from other people, because you know that Stick basically tells Matt to, like, isolate himself and not feel anything for other people. And obviously the same thing happened with Elektra. It's very cult-like behavior in having to isolate them so they have no support system, and therefore they're entirely reliant on the chase, basically, as a basis for everything. And it was kind of a little bit horrifying for me to see us flashing back to that and seeing how Stick basically manipulated a child, because she was a child, into doing what he needed and kind of maneuvering her in a game that she had no idea was being played, really.
What made me kind of cringe especially is just whatever this, like, black sky thing is that's, like, within her, because she's saying she has been been taught to fight it. And I feel like had she been trained and raised to know what it is and to embrace it and to use it to her advantage, if that's possible, then she would not have been so conflicted, because I'm gonna go Avatar here. She's like Zuko in a way, like with like honor and family, and like she's got the good Avatar and the bad Avatar in her background, like Zuko sort of thing, like the literal internal fight that she has over like what's going on within her and like what she was raised. And if they had done something like to embrace what she was, what Stick knew she was, she probably would have been healthier and probably a benefit to the Chaste.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. I think that keeping something like that from her, and even now, I'm still not entirely sure what the Black Sky is. I'm not entirely certain if it's supposed to be something that's kind of like the inhuman powers that we're seeing in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., whether it's something along those lines, like it's some kind of power. I just genuinely am very confused as to what it is, how it can be used, why the hand actually wants it, other than this person being like a figurehead for them. And what it is about them that the Chaste wants to stop. Because all we really see of Electra is that she has very limited impulse control when it comes to violence and killing. But in the same breath, we also have had a whole season here of seeing Frank killing people as well. So it's kind of not balanced out as being something wildly different than what we've already seen. I mean, we got that reference to the kid back in season one as being a Black Sky, and we saw that Nobu was basically like, this is really important, it's really rare, but there is another. And they do reference that kid or the Black Sky as the Bringer of Shadows, but again, I'm still not entirely sure on what the Black Sky is. Did anyone else get, like, a better idea of what it was supposed to be? Because I'm lost. It's not something from the comics, so I can't even draw from my information from comic backstory. I just genuinely have no idea where they're going with this.
Yeah,
no, I have no idea.
I have no clue either. The only thing, you know, when that child showed up in season one, like, he was chained down, like, clearly it represents, like, it's more than just, like, this driving force to kill that she has. Like, there's something else to this, because that child was enough of a threat that he was sent over in, like, its own shipping container and was chained down with, you know, a million things. So, clearly, it's a major threat that they want to, you know, be able to use and embrace. I have no idea other than that.
I just got really confused in general with a lot of the Electra and the Chaste and the hand stuff. Like, I didn't, the actual war that was referenced was really vague, other than it being over who gets Electra, but then there was no real explanation given as to why that was so important. It was so confusing and nondescript, and kind of, I would have thought that there would have been a more solid answer by the end of the season as to what the Black Sky was, but it was one of the things that I was really disappointed about. And just the hand in general for me, like, not only did I not really know what they were about, but they were just, like, generic bad guy ninjas that were just there because they needed them to be there. There was no kind of build-up of, like, their motivations. There was no build-up of pretty much anything. And it was kind of the same as what we got with in season one with the Yakuza and the Chinese Triad with Madame Gao. Like, we didn't really get much more other than these are bad guys and they're Asian and we need to fight them. That's it. That's all we've got. And it just kind of frustrates me that we at least got, even in this season, stuff like the Kitchen Irish and the Dogs of Hell. We got a little bit more of them and their actual kind of personalities and so on. It was just something that didn't really sit right with me, because we don't even have an interesting counterpoint to them within the season of, like, anyone outside of those groups that are actually good. We have no other Asian characters, Japanese, Chinese, or otherwise, who are ordinary people. And that really just does not sit right with me at all. And it was something that I'd had a problem with in season one. But I thought that when they announced that we were going to be getting Electra, and when we saw Stick initially, I knew from comic book background that Stick was a part of the Chaste, and we would probably eventually see the Hand, and we'd probably see other characters. And I thought in season two we would get at least characters who are a little bit more multifaceted and have counterpoints for them within the show, but they didn't really do anything with it. And I don't know if I'm alone in thinking that, but it was definitely something that didn't sit right with me, either in season one or this season. Gamble, how did you feel about just the Hand in general, and how they kind of handled that whole storyline? Oh, terrible puns. Gotta get at least one in per episode.
It was so intensely frustrating. I mean, for a start, there was just, as you mentioned, there were no outside characters from the Hand the way there were, the way we had Corrado, for example, as sort of that look into the actual personalities of the other groups that Frank's going after. But that seemed to be an issue with the season as a whole in terms of being less connected to Hell's Kitchen or the city as an actual place with people living in it. It was very much more of a randomized setting. And that sort of shows when I think someone says to Matt, it's the only neighborhood more riddled with drugs and crime than your own, Chinatown, which I found hilarious and a bit tone deaf, considering that we really don't know anything about the war. We only have Stick's word to go off, and Stick is a demonstrably unreliable narrator at best. And it's just a lot of mysterious names, a lot of mysterious ninjas, a giant hole, which I think never really got explained, and some human experimentation in the basement, which I also don't recall getting explained, though, again, this could just be me. But it was just incredibly irritating to see that sort of, it's a very old comics book trope, as far as I can tell, the yellow peril trope. And it happened in season one, but I didn't expect season two to hinge on it so heavily, to the extent that we have Madame Gao painting cherry blossoms in a basement and drinking tea, which I really don't see the point of that set piece. I really don't see where all the mysticism needs to come in, when season one, for example, was definitely grounded a little more in the actual impact of real human people crime and the way that that hurts the neighborhood, instead of, you know, the centuries old war that no one can really explain, but we know they must be doing something bad. So yeah, genuinely I wish that had been made more practical or explained a little more at least, but preferably I would just like about 8 hours of my life back in that sense.
Caitlin, how about you? How did you feel about the way that they handled this?
I mean, obviously they needed ninjas so people could do unnecessary parkour like Roy Harper on Arrow. Like, that was my main thought. There was a lot of unnecessary parkour in this season. But I thought from, like, the first couple episodes that we were going to get a lot more focus on the other gangs in Hell's Kitchen. Like, we almost open with the Irish, and I was thinking, oh, okay, we're going to start seeing some different gangs. That's interesting. That's going to be a break from what we saw before. That's really cool. And then that kind of went away, because that was Frank's story, and Frank's story kind of moves away from the gangs after a couple episodes. And so that was a little disappointing. It did feel a little lazy when they had a setup to be kind of interesting.
Yeah, I definitely agree with the unnecessary parkour. And they were zombie ninjas, which just makes them even cooler. I think Karen and I just enjoyed the ninja aspect of it. But yeah, they were kind of just confusing and a giant question mark. And I appreciated, like, the mystery of the giant hole and, like, them transporting the dirt out of there and, like, they dug a giant hole in the middle of Hell's Kitchen and nobody seems to know, hasn't noticed. Like, it's a feat all its own, but we have no idea why or what's going on with the giant hole or if we'll ever find out. And I would have liked to have known what that really was all about. So, yeah, the hand, while they were definitely a worthy foe, like someone, it gave Matt a new challenge in his fighting, didn't really present much more than that. So that was a bit of a letdown.
The other thing as well is that we're not really given much of an idea of what the peril is with the hand being in Hell's Kitchen. Because a lot of what Matt is fighting against is to keep that part of the city safe. But there's no real explanation of what they're doing that is making Hell's Kitchen unsafe. We don't really get any answer to that at all. And it is, you know, it's a fight that had no real resolution necessarily, because we don't really know what he was fighting against. He was just fighting ninjas. Like, I understand that it was them trying to get Elektra, but again, we don't know what the Black Sky does. We don't know why that was important. We don't know why Hell's Kitchen. It was just, it just felt like they wanted ninjas. That's, to me, that's...
Well, to play devil's advocate, really fun. Maybe, like, it almost feels like the writers were trying to keep the audience in the dark in the way that Matt felt with how little Stick would tell him. So it's sort of like we're sharing his kind of clueless perspective from Stick, because Stick's like the one sharing or not sharing the knowledge. So maybe we as the audience are supposed to have as little information as Matt does, essentially, and kind of go with him and see what he does with the lack of information that he has, and maybe feel the frustration that he feels of having so little information from Stick and still having to do something.
I mean, it was definitely frustration, because I don't know what that hole was for. And the only thing I can think of for, like, them bleeding dry those people that they abducted was possibly to fuel that. They had that big stone casket thing that they put Elektra in at the end that has the kanji for rebirth and resurrection on it. So I don't know if it's to fuel that to give her life again. That's a theory, because we're not actually told if that's what it's for, but because we see them being drained in close proximity to, like, tanks where that casket thing, that big stone casket, was being held, that's my only potential theory as to what the hell that was about. But I don't know, just in general, I didn't find the hand stuff as satisfying as I did Frank's storyline. And I really wish that they would give some kind of counterpoint of a character that normalized these kind of cultures outside of the bad guys, because they are the only ones so far that haven't been. So, you know, we get in pretty much the entire season, we will see characters like Foggy, like Karen, like Clemens at the paper. You know, we've got these fully fleshed out characters outside of the gangs, but we have no normalized Asian character. And it feels very much like a generalization of them, that they're all bad guys, pretty much. I think the only normal Asian characters that we saw were some of the guys in the restaurant who were in the kitchen when they run through that. And for me, that just doesn't... It doesn't feel right that in a place as multicultural as New York, that we haven't seen one normal Asian character, be they Chinese, Japanese, Filipino, anything, Korean, no one outside of mystical ninjas or Yakuza or the Chinese triad. And I don't know, I just find it really strange. And I guess the other thing is, like, that kind of comes back to the arguments a lot of people were making about having an Asian American Iron Fist as well. It just, with all of the conversation that's been going on with that, this just, for me, brought it kind of back to, like, a bigger problem in Marvel. But yeah, I don't know if you agree with that or not, or if you would want to see that explored a little bit more, because for me it was very, like, starkly obvious that they're the only groups of people in Daredevil that haven't had representation outside of being generic bad guys.
Yeah, I felt myself squirming at times, going, this is getting a little over the top with the evil Asians. Like, I did visibly feel uncomfortable with it at times.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that I would like to see them address in a season three. Like, there's plenty of opportunity for them to fix that problem, because it's we've only ever seen them as the leader, you know, with Gao and the leaders of the drug ring. And then you have this season where the Hand is just, you know, evil ninjas trying to take Elektra. Like, yeah, it definitely is something they need to work on. And if they had a season three, I would love to see them, like, change that.
Yeah, I really, really want to see them introduce some kind of character that we'll see for a prolonged amount of time that will give an alternate perspective. But I guess we'll have to wait. Either, I would imagine, for Iron Fist, who, if we don't have a massive cast of supporting Asian characters, because we don't know exactly where in Asia it's going to be set yet, because they haven't given us enough information on that. But if we don't have a very substantial cast of Asian characters there around Danny Rand, then I'm going to be side-eyeing Marvel pretty damn hard for their kind of almost refusal to show normal Asians on screen. And it, yeah. But I guess we'll hold out hope for season three and potentially Iron Fist, but for now it's definitely something that I'm keeping an eye on, because it was a lot more obvious in this season than season one. Because you could give it a bit of the benefit of the doubt in season one in respect to if you knew where some of the characters were coming from in respect to Stick and characters like Nobu, you could assume that they would expand on that in season two and address some of those issues. But I guess season three is where we will have to hope for that to come out. But I guess we did talk a little bit about Karen at the start, so let's get into her a little bit more. So we see her, aside from everything with Frank, really getting into investigative journalism through Nelson and Murdoch. And she basically takes on the role that Ben Urich had in season one. In fact, to the point where she is eventually offered a job at the New York Bulletin. Now, how did you feel about Karen's trajectory over this entire season? Do you feel like they developed her character a lot more from season one? Did you enjoy what they did with her in this season?
I thought Karen was the best part of this season. I loved her arc, both with Frank and with the journalism. It was interesting to see how her work for the trial kind of dovetails into just, hey, you're good at investigative journalism, period. So since there's no more Nelson and Murdoch, why don't you come and do that here? And for her to, you know, get Ben's office and kind of become the next Ben is, I think, really appropriate for her, because that was such a powerful relationship for her in the first season. And it was good to see her have this arc that was her very own. This wasn't dependent on a man, whether it was Matt or Frank. Like, it was sort of dependent on her boss at the paper, but not really. They were just kind of working together. This was really just a completely separate arc for her, and I really appreciated seeing her develop and grow just completely on her own.
Yeah, I really loved this arc for her, because the thing with Karen, especially in the comics, is that she's a really difficult character, because pretty much, for the most part, she is Matt's love interest on and off through the entire comic book series. And I love that they've deviated from that quite a lot, and they've given her a much stronger storyline in the TV series. I liked that she became almost the successor to Ben, even though I'm still really upset that Ben died. I'm still not over that from season one at all. But I kind of also really loved the little scene that we got between her and Clemens, where they are at the... It was the medical examiner. It was at the coroner that they were at after he'd been killed, and he sends her off to her apartment but makes two police officers go with her, and she's like, I don't need to deal with this patriarchal bullshit, essentially, and is like, I don't need you to treat me like that, you know, you wouldn't have done that to Ben. And when he turns around and he's basically like, no, but I should have done that with Ben, maybe if I'd have done that, he might still be here. And I kind of really just loved her relationship with him, and just everything about this journey for Karen for me was really great, because it just gave her so much outside of this relationship with Matt that they were building up, and that kind of attraction that they had on that. So she became her own fully fledged character on her own, with her own goals, her own motivations, and I really love that she's now carved a space for herself that we'll probably see her move forward with in season 3 as well, which I really, really enjoyed. Kristen, how about you?
Yeah, Karen was definitely the highlight of this season, and was, I think, a large part of why I loved this season. In, you know, completely separate from her and Castle's storyline, which I loved, I really liked seeing her and Ellison get close. Like, we had some problems with Ellison in season one just because him and Ben butted heads so often. But, like, by the end of season one, we learned that he really wasn't who we all kind of had fingered him to be. Like, we had all thought he had been on, you know, on Fisk's side of things. And to find out that he wasn't, and that it was, you know, someone else in the office. This season, like, seeing him and Karen kind of work together, and her kind of learn what she needs to know about the journalism angle of this rather than just the investigative angle, which she's already good at, was really, really fun for me. And seeing her literally step into dues, like driving his car and working out of his office. And, you know, it was really fun for me. I definitely want to see her, you know, working with Foggy and Matt, possibly, you know, further on, but doing it from her role as an investigative journalist, doing it with her own goals in mind. And if she can help them, then absolutely. But I'm so glad that she has moved on and found something that gives her that feeling, the sense of accomplishment. Like, you can tell just how fulfilling it is for her when she finds this niche that she just fills so well. So yeah, I love Karen Page. She is my hero.
I am glad that she's finding that niche as a character outside of that firm, because basically she does have, as far as I can tell, two friends in New York, and they're constantly fighting, and one of them is secretly a vigilante until the end of the season. And it wasn't fun in season one to have her so out of the loop by the end of a season. And for most of this one as well, it was incredibly awkward because she does, you know, take those gambles. She does take those risks, and she pushes for those answers, which I think works in the niche that TV journalism has got set up for investigative reporters. But the journalism in this season honestly made me miss season one journalism, or possibly even House of Cards journalism. And that last voiceover really gave me some serious doubts about how realistic this show is. Just in terms of the editor sitting down going, write a story only you can write. It was very much a platitude for a show that seems to try and root itself in, you know, real people and real lives and to a certain extent real law, although that seems to have gone a bit this season as well. So I like the idea, but I'm a bit dubious about how well they're going to execute it at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it was something that I kind of thought a little bit about from season one as well, like in respect to they're basically investigating in print, they are putting out newspapers, whereas a lot of stuff now as well is online, and it just it kind of was like really strange for me because it made me think about the Ben Urich stuff where he was basically posting a lot of the stuff he was finding on like a blog essentially that was going to get like no one looking at it. But it's kind of straddling this kind of modern world and a sort of older version of how journalism worked maybe 10 odd years ago. But I do like that this is a direction that they're taking her in, though, because I think that she should be having something outside of Nelson and Murdoch, because it was great through season one and through most of the season to have her still connected to those two characters. But then I like that they're separating her off and giving her her own storyline and her own motivations and her own things. But yeah, I don't know how I feel about like the print journalism in respect to a lot of it doesn't happen that way anymore. That's definitely an interesting angle to be looking at it from. I don't watch House of Cards, though. I will put my hands up. So I don't know what happens in that series either. And probably I'm getting the side eye from a lot of listeners at this point for admitting that. I should imagine. I just never watched it. So let's talk about the other half of Nelson and Murdoch. So, Foggy this season. I really, really, really loved Foggy this season a lot. Because where Matt basically started to implode in respect to his professional life as a lawyer, Foggy, for as much as he was saying that he needed Matt to do certain things, that they both had their strengths within the firm, he really genuinely, honestly did not need Matt for most of that. In fact, he pretty much carried the Frank Castle case and the whole law firm, essentially, on his own. Especially when Matt starts spiraling when Elektra comes back into town. But how did you feel about how Foggy stepped up to the plate here? Especially after Matt got him tangled up in having to take on Frank Castle's case.
Well, Foggy Nelson, oh my god. I don't remember exactly where the first speech of his came in. I can't remember the circumstances. But the second one stands out in my mind, like, with him and Claire in the emergency room. And that whole scene, like, it's just, it solidifies exactly what Foggy is and what he, like, he is that better half that Matt did not have this season. He is that, you know, the law can do good and I am going to do good and I'm going to make sure of it kind of thing. And I just, Foggy was the saving grace for Nelson and Murdoch, especially with Matt going down such a dark path. I loved that despite the fact that he did not want to take on the Castle trial and Matt's insistence that he did, and then Matt completely abandons him to handle it. Like, Foggy may not have thought he handled it. He may not have thought that he stepped up to the plate and took care of things, but he did. And I love that the season sort of ends with someone else outside of Matt and Karen telling him, "You did good. You did more than good, and someone else has seen it and is, you know, interested in taking him on." And that just, it, you know, you can see in Foggy's head that he just does not think he's good enough, and he does not see himself being able to exist in a world without Matt as his crutch. And by the end of the season, you see that Foggy doesn't need Matt in the legal world at all, like as a friend, possibly, if they can find a way back to each other. But, you know, in the legal world, in a professional world, Foggy can do it all on his own. even if he's not quite sure he can yet. So, yeah, I love me some Foggy Nelson. He did an amazing job this season, and I can't wait to see where he goes from here.
I really loved what they did with Foggy this season, just in terms of him realizing that he can't continually drag Matt out of the fire, and that at a certain point he does have to leave Matt to handle his own stuff and trust that Matt will figure out what's best for him, and that he can't be that sort of unilateral support system almost, because Matt really does just drop so much on him this season. So I was really glad that by the end of the season he was having those conversations, he was deciding to do something else that's better for him. And I'm also really interested to see if he's going to turn up. And I think Jessica Jones, as a result, I really want to see what they do with it. I think that was one of the storylines, the characters that they left in a place that could be really interesting and still hold on to some of that original Nelson and Murdoch sort of casework atmosphere.
Yeah, I kind of liked how they kind of drew that together, because one thing when I was watching Jessica Jones was that I always wondered why we didn't hear a little bit more about Nelson and Murdoch, especially when we were focusing on Jerry Hogarth and HCMB as a firm, because that case against Wilson Fisk in the first season was no small case, even for a law firm that wasn't necessarily a well-known firm. So it always seemed a little strange to me that, especially within the legal sphere, that they hadn't really mentioned each other much. I like that they've corrected that, and it's now a potential that we're going to see Foggy move into potentially having to interact with Jessica, or maybe we might even see him interact with Luke Cage, or maybe even Danny Rand whenever they introduce all of that in as well. But it kind of just widens the universe a little bit more and opens it up to allow some of the characters to kind of cross over, whether that's in a big way or a smaller way, but I really like that. Caitlin, how about you?
So Foggy was both one of my biggest happy places and one of my biggest disappointments. He was so wonderful for the first half of the season, and then he's completely sidelined for the back half of the season, which I found really disappointing. He gets shot in the arm, and then we see him like a couple of times after that, which I just missed him. So it was a disappointment that he just sort of vanished for so much of it. Like, for the hand plot that nobody could figure out what was going on, I would rather be spending time with Foggy, because he was so good for the first part of the season. He was coming into his own. He was realizing, you know, where his priorities need to be, and making a healthy decision to, like, basically cut ties professionally with Matt, because Matt just was not pulling his weight. And I think he had one of the healthiest reactions to everything that was going on in that way. But then not seeing him for so much of the second half was a real bummer for me. I wanted more.
Yeah, I definitely did as well. Just a little, like, sort of tease from stuff that's come from the comics. I'm wondering if introducing him to a bigger firm may be a way of putting him on the trajectory to eventually become district attorney within this universe, because in the comic books, that's exactly what happens eventually. Foggy becomes district attorney, and we did see another character introduced this season that is actually really tangled up in that storyline with Foggy as well. So Blake Tower, who was Reyes's assistant, eventually, when Foggy comes to re-election again, Blake Tower actually runs against him. So I'm wondering if seeing him move to a bigger firm and get what is a substantially bigger role in respect to his professional career may see him eventually become district attorney down the line and play into things in a much bigger way and have a much larger influence on a lot of the events that happen when it comes to basically everything to do with the legal system surrounding characters like Daredevil, Frank Castle, Jessica Jones. We're gonna get more of like Luke Cage and Iron Fist as well, but with Civil War on the horizon, and accountability for people with powers or abilities and so on. And still, we don't know if that's going to be isolated just to the Avengers as a group, or whether that's going to include all people who kind of operate as like a with some kind of vigilante justice without government oversight. Like, it would be really interesting to see someone who has had that kind of experience with vigilantes within their personal life and their professional life take up like a bigger role in a legal aspect for me. I don't know how you feel about that as like a potential direction for taking Foggy.
I kind of hope he doesn't become the district attorney, because that doesn't seem to be real safe. He gets into enough trouble as is without being in such a high profile position. So putting him in one like that, I would worry even more about him than I already do.
Protect Foggy Nelson at all costs.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Kristen, how about you? Would you like to see Foggy become the district attorney? Or do you think he would be safer just staying as a lawyer with Jerry's firm?
I mean, safer, yeah. He definitely should stay away from the district attorney's office. But I do think he could do a lot of good from there. Like, just after seeing all of the corruption with Reyes this season, and I feel like he could do good work as the district attorney. So in that aspect, I would love to see him take on that role. But I'm not sure if it would be the safest option for him. So, yeah. I love me some Foggy, and I'd love to see him get more opportunity like that. I just don't know. Maybe Matt would be his bodyguard and keep him safe. That's important, though.
I think it would be really interesting to see him do sort of politicking that Reyes clearly did to advance her career, because he seems to have that sort of, while he cares as much about the people of Hell's Kitchen, the people who they help and who pay them in, you know, pie rather than actual hourlies, just as much as Matt does, he also very much has that ability to prioritize when it comes to taking that last meeting, when it comes to originally, you know, filling a box with bagels and stealing them from the conference room. Mostly I just really want someone to get him a box full of bagels and considerably better friends, but I'd be really interested to see the sort of him doing that character shift into a slightly more, I suppose, institutionally powerful Foggy. That's a weird phrase, but I would be interested to see it, but also get him a box of bagels.
I love that. Get him a box of bagels and better friends. That's my line of the entire episode. I love it. Because it's not far wrong. I think, yeah, seeing him with more influence on what he could do, because especially the character that he is, I think that would be quite an interesting thing to do. But again, I'm also interested in seeing what he'll get up to working with Jerry, and maybe hopefully seeing a little bit more of him and Marcy as well, because that I loved seeing them together again this season. I thought that was really... It was a really nice return for her character as well. The other character that we saw return and also leave as well was Claire. So Claire came back. Last time we saw her was in Jessica Jones, where she basically helped out with Luke Cage at the end of the season and basically managed to sneak him out of the hospital without discharging him or doing any of the proper paperwork. And we see that she has some circumstances from that come back into play in this season, where she basically has her first strike and she has been moved entirely to the night shift, which is clearly a nod to her role as the night nurse in the comic books. But Matt uses his connection to her in a really not so great way in respect to getting those weird comatose, drained blood abductees that kind of end up under her watch in a part of the hospital that is kind of shut down and being renovated. And she ends up caught up in the middle of a load of the hand nonsense And basically when the hospital kind of starts going, hey, we're just going to hush this up and cover it up because we've been given a lot of money to keep this on the down low, she decides to just hand in her badge and peace out. Now, this was a very obvious shift because she's going to be heading to Luke Cage as a regular, so they needed to have some way to get her to Harlem, but how did you feel about Claire's return in this season after we last saw her in Jessica Jones, but also how they handled essentially writing her off this season to give her the proper motivation to be in Harlem by the time Luke Cage arrives at the end of this year?
Coming out of season one, Claire was one of my absolute favorite characters, but it was, as you were recapping what happened this season, which was useful, I remembered about 30% of that. It was interesting to see that she's willing to flout regulations for Matt and for, I suppose, because she knows he's doing the right thing, or for whatever reason, because it's about taking care of these people and protecting them. But then when it comes to the hospital, essentially trying to continue operating, that's a moral event horizon of sorts for her, because she strikes me as a reasonably pragmatic character. She's working night ER shifts at basically the equivalent of Bellevue, which seems like a risky proposition at best. She seems to be used to brawls in the middle of, you know, the inpatient facilities. But it didn't make character sense to me that she would go, oh, you know, no, you're not helping people by doing this, I quit. Because essentially what they're covering up is the fact that they have a body that was walking around with a previously healed or previously sewn up autopsy incision. And I'm not really sure what she expected to do other than, you know, I suppose look into it under her own steam or do something similar, because I really can't think of a good way of launching some sort of public investigation into possible ninja zombies. And it seemed like an obvious write-off to me, and one that didn't necessarily do her character justice. I wasn't very happy with the way they handled that.
I mean, she was also protesting the fact that her friend was murdered and they were pretending it didn't happen, which seemed fair enough to me.
So. I mean, I see where you're coming from, but it just, what alternative, I suppose, would they have had? That's what I'm boggling over.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the alternative would have been either, because who would genuinely believe ninja zombies if that was to go public? Ninja zombies broke into the hospital and killed people. I don't know how they'd be able to twist that, but I am in another vein, I am like exceedingly excited to see her move as like a regular character across to Luke Cage, because I do really love her as a character, and seeing her a lot more would be great. But I just love how she doesn't take Matt's nonsense, like, at all. And she basically tells him straight every single time they come into contact, and she's basically like, you're being an idiot. Will you stop being an idiot? You're messing up. He doesn't listen, but at least Claire Foggy and Karen basically turning around and being like, Matt, you are dumb. Stop being a dumb. And Matt's just like, how about I just do that anyway? Yeah, but I always enjoy seeing Claire, honestly. But Caitlin, how did you feel other than like weird zombie ninjas?
I mean, I love that Claire is too good for Matt and she knows it and just goes with that, which is kind of my favorite thing. Which is what you were talking about. She doesn't take his crap because she doesn't need to. So I love that about her. I was very happy to see her. I enjoyed the references to her actions in Jessica Jones. I love the nods that we get that the world's expanding. And I did think it was a pretty obvious write-off, but I didn't think it was totally out of character when she had just watched someone who was a friend of hers like be murdered protecting her. Like, I can buy that.
Yeah, no, as far as Claire goes, I'm really excited to see her in Luke Cage. They had to get her there. I can see why they used it. It was funny because Karen and I were watching and we had literally just said how much we liked her nurse friend. Like, we had just said, like, you know, she showed up a few times and we really love her. And then she dies. And we were like, no, like, yell. It was really funny. Just the timing of it was ridiculous. So I can see why that would be more of an impetus for Claire to want to get out of there. And she, you can kind of tell that she had had it with some of the things that she had been dealing with. So as much as the zombie ninjas were, I almost tried to make them their own name. As much as the zombie ninjas are definitely one of the reasons she's leaving, I think there's more to it than that. Like, she just, you know, she needs to get out of there. She's ready for some change, and I'm just happy to see more of her. So if that's what it takes, then sure. Send her, you know, have her move to Harlem. I'm on board.
Yeah, because we also know that we're going to be getting her mother in Luke Cage as well. So I wonder if when we come back and see her again, maybe her mother lives in Harlem. Maybe that's where she's going. She's going to go and think that she's lying low for a little bit over there after everything that went down, and then runs into Luke Cage again and is like, really? Can I just never catch a break? Poor Claire. Guys, is there anything else that you want to add about this season before we wrap up? Like, any random thoughts of anything that maybe we didn't cover?
Fisk?
Oh my god! Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah.
The big oh my god moment where I was just, like, not expecting that at all. Kudos to everyone in, like, the marketing of this for keeping that on the down low, because I didn't even get, like, an inkling that we were going to get him until, right up until they walked Frank out into, like, that gym kind of workout area bit. I was like, oh my god. It didn't even connect until right up until that moment that's where they were going with it. But holy crap, Fisk, basically. Oh man, did anyone expect that around the point where we got, like, where Frank basically tanked his entire trial and got sent straight to prison? Did anyone see that coming?
No. I wasn't sure if they were sending him out there to kill Fisk or if they were sending him out there to be used by Fisk. Like, I didn't know. And as he steps out and you see this giant bald man, like, you put it together. You're like, oh my gosh, that's Fisk. Like, and in that second, I'm going, why is he there? Is he there to kill him? That would be amazing. But I promise that's probably not what's going to happen. And then, you know, the scene goes on. So I did really love the surprise. And it was really well done and hidden by them. I didn't see it coming until you were literally in the courtyard, like, they were staring each other down, and it's like, okay, here we go. So, yeah, nice little surprise.
Yeah, the other thing I really liked is that, obviously, even though he's in prison and technically keeping his head down, he still has a huge amount of influence. This is a really good way of setting him up as the actual kingpin, especially because we got a nod to the name when he was basically like, there can only be one kingpin kind of thing. And I kind of like that he's still dipping his toe and still keeping everything going in respect to still staying in some semblance of power. But also, Matt, you are such a dumb, because of all of the people to enrage, even though he's in prison, like, why would you rile up Wilson Fisk? And the fact that now Fisk is basically back on the I've got to do something about this guy, I've got to take him out of the game completely, without even really knowing that he's Daredevil either. Like, Matt, you are such a dumb. So stupid. But
it sure seemed like he was being set up to figure it out, the way he was asking to get Matt's files to look over them again.
Yeah, I think we will see Fisk figure that out eventually, but Gamble, how about you? Are you, I mean, I don't think any of us expected this, but how did you feel about them reintroducing Fisk again into this season?
I didn't see it coming at all, but it was a breath of fresh air for me, honestly, because I did enjoy the comparative cohesion anyway of season one, and it was very nice to be reminded that there is presumably some long game to this show, and that Fisk has a plan, and Fisk is still doing his thing, and it was very nice to hear, you know, his speech patterns and get that sense of very quiet but present menace. So I really enjoyed that completely unexpected appearance.
I just loved it, and I love the way he is kind of, I don't know, I find it so fascinating that he's playing the long game in terms of, like, it keeps Vanessa safe, and he's going to kind of come out of prison more or less in good position to take things over, like, all the, he's letting all the, like, gang wars take everybody else out, so he's going to come in a position of power, and he's just smart enough to put the pieces into play and let them fight it out. It's just so fascinating to watch him move the chess pieces even from behind bars. Like, that really was not that big of a setback to him, even though it was this huge accomplishment for Matt to take him down eventually. It doesn't end up being as big a thing based on the way he's approaching things. And I think that's really both amazing and disheartening.
Yeah, it is. And we're probably, by the time we either get to, because we're obviously going to get a Daredevil season 3. They haven't announced it, but I mean, it's obvious that we will probably get it. But I think by the time we either get to there, or by the time we get to the Defenders, we will see him back out and in the world again, and causing a considerable hassle for Matt, if not Daredevil as well. But, anything else to add?
Nope.
No
less thoughts. We didn't really get much feedback from listeners who have watched Daredevil season 2, because apparently we binge watched it like crazy. The only person who has, I think, seen it, or even part of it, is Janik, who sent us an email saying, "Hey guys, I know I'm only halfway through season 2, but since you're already taping your special due to your insane binge-watching skills, I've compiled a list of pros and cons in classic Jimmy Fallon style on what I think of the show so far. So, pro, Matt being alive and kicking in his awesome Daredevil suit. Con, then getting shot in the head because, well, the Punisher is awesome. Pro, sound design and lighting is amazing. Con, so are the fight scenes, if you count out the fact that they're 10 times longer than season 1. Pro, Elektra being the perfect female embodiment of Matt. Con, Foggy getting sidelined every damn episode because Matt apparently needs a girlfriend. Pro, Karen. Con, well, I guess she shouldn't run in heels." So, they're about halfway through. So, you've got a lot more to go, Janik. So whenever you're done, feel free to come back to us and give us a little bit more feedback. And the same for anyone else who is watching. We would love to hear some of your thoughts, either in the comments when this goes up on Hyperball, or again, tweet at us, which is at Hero Hype Podcast, or, yeah, again, email us, herohypepodcast@gmail.com. But that's it for our Daredevil special. Thank you both Caitlin and Gamble for coming on and joining us for this conversation, and I hope you guys had fun.
You mean Kristen,
oh my,
yeah,
god,
hi. Names are hard, don't worry.
That's sort of funny to me because my sister's name is Kristen, and so people like use our wrong names all the time, so that's like perfect family right there.
Yeah. Aww.
Yeah, basically not only is Matt a dumb, Donya is a dumb.
But we knew that.
Yeah. Oh, there we go. It's everyone ganging up on me now. I'm glad you.
Well, Karen's not here, so someone needs someone.
Yeah.
True.
But yes, I just thank you, Gamble and Kristen, for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. It was fun. Yeah.
But I guess until our next episode, guys, I'm Donya.
I'm Caitlin.
I'm Gamble.
And I'm Kristen.
And we'll see you for our next episode. Thanks for listening to this, guys. Bye.
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 Bye.